chapter and the next chapter relate to Cain, the two most important events in human history. Last week, we ended with Pilate posting a sign above the cross in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, the King of the Jews. So that's where we pick up today in verses 23 and 24. So the soldiers gambling for Jesus' garments. I have down that Dennis will answer the last question. So the first question would be for you, Graham, if you want it. Why were the clothes of Jesus stripped from him? And the second question in that number one is, why is it important for us to know the soldiers, what the soldiers did with his clothes, Graham?
For the first question, I kind of answered it as far as what the motivation was for the soldiers. They agreed, or it was in order to show humiliation for those that were up on the cross. Jesus replied, as well as the thieves as well. And most of the entire process was just to show humiliation. So that was just another step in the whole process. And then for the second one, which is kind of related to the first one, why is it important for us to know what the soldiers did? It's a fulfillment of prophecy. We saw the prophecy in Psalm 22, then almost that entire psalm is prophecy. Fulfillment of that.
Very good. Yes. Yeah. Psalm 22, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Who else would like to address this gambling for Jesus' garments? Awesome.
I think Grant said pretty much all I had to say on that, but I think it's interesting too. We're going to notice some prophecies in all of this that are completely outside of Jesus' control. This being one of those. Jesus didn't have any control over what they did with his garments. Jesus wasn't a person who would allow someone just to take his garments, just off the street, you know, any old day. So this was a moment in time where he forcibly has his clothing removed from him for shameful, humiliating, derision-filled reasons, all of which are horrible, all of which are part of the shame that was associated with the cross, a part that I think sometimes we forget, a part that maybe we don't talk about simply because it is off-putting, but a part nevertheless. But the second part is the fact that this was a prophecy that is so specific. It's so, it's a minute detail. And in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter to us what happened to his clothing, other than to show that this was indeed something of divine nature. And the prophecy was of divine nature.
Yeah, that's a good point. He couldn't, in a state, as a man, couldn't cause that to be fulfilled. Anyone else on this? Cole.
I thought it was interesting because in America, we don't see clothes as valuable as they did back in the day. So the soldiers, there's a humiliation aspect. They also probably really wanted Jesus' clothes. And I think that also speaks to the divine nature of the prophecy before, because it was written before the Roman Empire existed. So shows that whoever wrote that prophecy know that the soldiers would have gambled for those clothes.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I mean, we've got closets full of clothes, and you know, this was Jesus's really only his only earthly possession, and they took it. Who else would like to address this?
No. I found it interesting to consider if Jesus was completely naked or not. And the Romans' pattern was to crucify you naked. You know, they were going to maximize the humiliation and make an example of you as best they could. But then you've got a little bit of twist on this. I think the Jewish leadership would have wanted as much shame as possible, as much shame and embarrassment on Jesus as possible. So I think from their standpoint, they probably wanted him naked. Although they would have probably left that up to the Romans. There's all kinds of speculation here. We don't really know, but I think it's interesting to think about. Pilate, maybe, in a little bit of a poke back at the Jews, might have allowed him to have a loincloth on to hide some of that embarrassment. So I think it's just interesting to consider. There's pros and cons for both sides, but the Romans definitely crucified folks naked, so we don't know. And there was reading about different painters that would paint the scene, and some put, we don't know all those details, but I think it's interesting to consider.
Yeah, you're right. And perhaps along with the humiliation, there would be some torture aspect to this, because it would expose a person further to the elements, to the cold, to the sun, the flies, the birds, and all that. I saw one person or one commentator made a connection, back to Genesis 3:10, where the humiliation of being naked came from the fall, and here we see it again at the cross. Anybody else want to move on to question two? Question number two. Who was present at the cross? This covers verses 25 to 27. Who was present at the cross? Why did Jesus entrust the care of his mother to John? And why not allow her to be taken care of by his brothers? Trace, would you like to address this?
Yeah. So for the first part, who was present at the cross? Well, this is also mentioned in Mark 15:40, but it says there in verse 25 that Jesus' mother was there, and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So, and Mark's account has the same people there right at the foot of the cross. And it's not accounting for everyone that is there, but just there at the foot. So that answers the first part. And why did Jesus entrust the care of his mother to John? John was like one of his closest followers. I would say that was probably the main reason. John was closer to him than his own brothers, from what we read in Scripture. That would be as good a reason as any. And then why not allow her to be taken care of by his brothers? Well, like I said, it doesn't even name off his brothers that are there. I mean, I would think they were, but I don't know that Scripture doesn't necessarily say that. So, I think that John was just the best individual there, and he was there, so that meant the choice pretty apparent to him.
Thank you. Who else would like to address who was at the cross? There's a lot of debate on who was at the cross, because there's a lot of ways to read that. Who would like to address who was at the cross, and why did Jesus choose John? John over one of his brothers. Mark.
Well, the women stand out here. Certainly are impressive. They were the first ones at the tomb, and they were the ones gathered around the cross. And all four gospel writers note that the women were there. Matthew and Mark say many women. And so we don't know exactly which ones. It's a little confusing. We tried to struggle through it a little bit in our study. And we don't know for sure. Punctuation in the Greek, for example, makes it difficult to know. Several Marys, of course. Lots of Marys. And only John, as Trace has pointed out, among the apostles, is present. So all the other have fled. And John is the only one there. Why didn't Jesus have some of his half-brothers take care of his mother. Well, at this point, they weren't believers. They were unbelievers. And of course, they came around later. But so John is the obvious choice, as he is a believer, and he's the only apostle. You know, he was beloved to Jesus. He was very close to Jesus, and they had a very close connection. And he is the only one there, as Trace pointed out. So it does make an obvious choice. And also, John is going to live a long time. So, you know, pick one of the apostles who dies quickly. And so Jesus knew these facts about John, and it just made amazing sense.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point that Jesus knew that John was going to be there. Who else would like to address any of these questions? Who was there and why John? Levi.
I thought it was interesting. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8 says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his own household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So I just love how good of an example Jesus is. Even he's so thoughtful, even on his dying moments, and he says to his mother, and make sure his mother is taken care of. So I like that.
Right. And Jesus, he knows the hearts of everybody. He knew that John was the right person. That's a very good point. Landon.
As to who were the women were present, this was something that I studied when I was doing the introduction to the book of James. And in there, it's all about like who wrote the book of James. We know there's three Jameses in the Bible, the son of Zebedee, Alphaeus, and then Clopas. And one of the points a commentator I raised when I was going through the book of James was that Alphaeus and Clopas, although similar, were distinct people. They weren't the same person. And so if you take that into consideration, when it's talking about the women at Jesus' cross, when it says there stood at the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas. Mary, the wife of Clopas, would not be his mother's sister, but a different Mary. And then Mary Magdalene. And then he also goes on to make the point that it would just be weird if parents named both of their daughters Mary. Jesus' mother's name's Mary, and her sister is also Mary. And that just doesn't really make any sense whatsoever. Dad has a hard enough time trying to remember our names because we all start with L, so it doesn't really make much sense from a parent standpoint.
Could have just ran out of names. Yes. Yeah, I should have opened this, I think, in PowerPoint instead of Keynote, because I spent a little time last night highlighting the different Marys that I thought was in there and how people would connect them. It's gone now. It's kind of, I seem to have some display problem. But it is interesting that there are, you know, there's several Marys here. And I think to your point, a lot of people were, some commentators were trying to say, that, I think, where is it in here, that Mary, the mother of James the Less and Joseph, was Mary, the wife of Clopas.
Yeah. I don't think I explained it very well with what I said, but it's kind of confusing. The thing is that, this is what Catholics believe as well, it's that James, son of Alphaeus, is the same person as James, son of Clopas. And they're both sons of Mary. And if you believe that, you have to believe that they're both sons of Jesus' mother's sister, Mary, wife of Clopas. But the point the commentator was making, that Clopas and Alphaeus are two different people. And so that's why this verse doesn't make any sense. He says I think it naturally progresses as sets of two. You have Jesus' mother, his mother's sister, and then you have the next set of two, the wife, Mary, wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene.
Right. Very good. So that left me wondering if Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, is Mary, mother of Jesus, because we have here and his brothers, James and Joseph. But I never found any commentator saying that that was the case, but I was wondering that. And it's also, I mean, we focus in on the Marys because there's a lot of them, but I think it's important to notice that John doesn't really say it, but the other ones, the other writers, all mention the centurions there. You know, and we have the centurion mentioned, and then we have those with him. So there's several soldiers here. And, you know, there's others around here. Seems like this is an important thing to think about, to kind of place yourself there to know what that crowd, trying to think of what that crowd is like. Austin, you go.
Also, the other thing, Luke's account there talks about how his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee. Earlier in Luke 23, I think I have the verse in here somewhere, verse 27, I think it talks about how there was a large crowd of women following Jesus when he was carrying the cross, I believe. And the point being that this wasn't just a remote little thing that was transpiring. This is a very public event. And I believe there's other passages that talk about people walking by and wagging their heads, saying that the one who saved others couldn't save himself, and so on and so forth. So it'd be interesting to know, like, if the Marys perhaps were the ones that stayed for the full duration. I don't know if duration, where that comes into this whole conversation. Why they are specifically mentioned as opposed to others who may have came and left after a certain period of time. But something to think about, I guess.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Just to, like you said, to help us understand the situation or the setting. Remember when we were studying a couple, either last week or the week before, there were four Roman guards with each prisoner. So there would be and a centurion. So there was at least 13 Roman guards there. And it would seem to me like the four that are soon going to be splitting up Jesus' garments, they were probably the four that crucified Jesus. And so they would have a right. And that was the practice. The executioner was able to claim the clothes. And so those four probably claimed Jesus' clothes. The other four, whatever might have been left from the first thief and whatever was left from the second thief, that would be how they were probably divvying those up as well. So I think I like what you're, because I like trying to imagine the setting as well.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't considered that they were also taking the thieves' clothing, but they certainly would have. Okay. Anybody else? So, we talked a little bit about why John, Bart brought out that John lived longer, especially longer than James. We have here that Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and then the mother of Zebedee's sons. So, John's mother was there, and there's a connection with, I think, so we have Salome. So most people think that Salome was James and John's mother, and perhaps that was his sister. So there might have been, they might have been cousins. So that might have been another reason. I don't know if we can say that for certain, but there may have been also some family connection. Anybody else for removal? Question number three. What was the purpose of Jesus being given vinegar on hyssop? And the second part, why did Jesus say, "It is finished," upon tasting vinegar? Mela.
So, I mean, in verse 28, Jesus says, I thirst, him on the cross. And so it appeared right after this is when the Roman soldiers, I believe, were offering this up to him. So I think it's, you know, maybe they were giving it to quench his thirst. Probably gets God after this. So I think that's what it was. There's also some debate as to whether this was showing compassion or whether it was more kind of torture. So there was kind of sour wine, vinegar stuff. So I did find it interesting that the hyssop plant is also used for cleansing and purification in other parts of the Bible, like Psalms 51:7. Also, another interesting fact that I found was that the Romans actually had a drink. I think it's called Poshka, which was a drink that was made from vinegar and honey and herbs. And so it allowed them to actually stay hydrated longer. And I guess maybe the flavor will bring more saliva and moisture to your mouth. So it allowed them to stay more hydrated. I guess the second part would be, why did Jesus say it is finished upon tasting the vinegar? I think he knew his time was up. That he freely gave up his life here. And I think that it's probably, I guess, beyond our comprehension exactly what that means. But I think we know that he knew that it was coming to the end.
Good. Thank you. We also like to talk about the vinegar and the hyssop. And why Jesus said, it is finished. Awesome.
Kaufman had in his commentary, he says, there is no way that any person except an eyewitness would have filled this account with so many specific details. The words before us are clearly the result of a vivid, menial picture in the mind of the narrator of what he had seen, the vessel full of vinegar, the sponge, the very kind of stick used to lift it to the Lord's mouth. No forger would have dared to piece together such a narrative. And I think that's really true. He also adds that he doesn't think that Jesus said, I thirst, in order to fulfill prophecy, which I disagree with. It may have been twofold. I believe he was very thirsty. That's one of the main things associated with crucifixion. But it is finished when he says that. I think there are... He knows what has to transpire. He knows what is in his control. And I believe when he says that, that all things that were in his control to fulfill had been fulfilled. And then he gave up the ghost. I think it's interesting the way that that's put.
Who else?
So the hyssop tree plant, a lot of times what I read was this thing would have a 1 foot to 3 foot stalk. And so that stalk, if you think about a sponge being on the end of it and a man standing and raising his arms, so, you know, Jesus might have been 8 to 10 feet off the ground. You know, not. I mean, I had it in my mind higher. That hyssop isn't such a long stem. So it wouldn't have been real high. So that's one bit of interesting information, I thought. I think Jesus was wanting to wet his lips and be able to clear his throat for the announcement in verse 30 of it is finished. And that's I think in my mind that's not just a simple it's finished. I found a writer named Morris. He wrote, Jesus died with the cry of the victor on his lips. This is not the moan of the defeated, nor the sign of patient resignation. It is the triumphant recognition that he has now fully accomplished the work that he came to do. That word that was translated, it is finished. Austin, Barb, you got it, to telestia. In ancient Greek, that was the cry of the winner. That was the cry that the winner would utter in a race or a competition. And to me, and it's also the verb of that, teleo, that was also written on receipts, paid in full.
Pagan thoughts. Good connection there. Anybody else on this one? The, Malo mentioned the vinegar. So, yeah, it's not the stuff that we clean our coffee maker with. What I read is probably the sour wine that soldiers drank, and they usually kept it with them in their rations. The hyssop I found pretty interesting too. So, like Kaufman and most commentators think that the hyssop was the reed. So, we have there in Matthew 27:48, they put it on the reed. Another, this Clark, I think, thought this, it may perhaps they used it to bind it to the reed, the hyssop, because it is kind of a spindly stuff. So, don't know without actually seeing hyssop, but it is a, it's, and it is used in a lot of medicinal things today. And I think it's kind of interesting that here in Exodus, that's what was used to wipe the blood on the doorposts on Passover. And it's finished. That was a very important thing. So it was the end of the age. And I think it was Kaufman's commentary I saw that he had the different things that were finished, you know, when that happened. Finished the law of Moses in Colossians 2:14-16. It finished the Sabbath. It was the end of his ministry, and in Hebrews 2:14, end of the power of Satan. Atonement for sins, Hebrews 9:26. And it also bought the church, Acts 20:28. Question number 4. Several parts to this one. Why did the Jews request that the bodies be taken away before the Sabbath day? Why is it significant that Jesus did not have his legs broken? What does the blood and the water from the side of Jesus indicate? And would it have any spiritual significance? Logan?
Jews, during this crucifixion, there may be a couple of reasons for why they wanted the body taken down. The most obvious being the Sabbath is coming up. The holy day is upon them, and they don't want that sight kind of disrespecting the holy day, the sanctity of the holy day. Another one is just the Jewish leaders that hated him wanted to get him in the tomb and forgotten. You know, they don't want that lingering during the Sabbath. They don't want people remembering Jesus at that point in time. You know, we've gotten rid of this, we've eliminated this problem. Now it's time to get back to the way we want to do things. As for his legs not being broken, there's a couple of verses in the Old Testament here. Some prophecy in Psalm 34:20. He guards all of his bones, not one of them is broken. And if we're talking about the sacrificial lamb, Exodus 12:46, it says, "In one house it shall be eaten, you shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones." So it was very important that that was not to be done during that sacrifice. And what does the blood and water from the side of Jesus indicate here? Does it have spiritual significance? I didn't have too much on this. When we were studying this, Dad mentioned a sermon that Johnny Elmore gave a long, long time ago, I guess, where he mentioned in Genesis when the rib is taken out of Adam, that there's a connection to be made here with Christ on the cross, the spear going into his side. How from Adam's rib, you know, husband to the wife, from the husband, the wife was taken. It's kind of the same way with the church. As after Jesus' side spears, we have the establishment of the church. So just kind of an interesting premise for a lesson there. And that's something that Johnny Elmore came up with. But another man had a similar statement. A guy named Tertullian from the 2nd century, which Dad thinks that might be where Johnny Elmer got this, but he says, "If Adam was a figure of Christ, the sleep of Adam was the death of Christ, who was to fall asleep in death. But in the injury of his side, might be figured the church, the true mother. So, I don't know, just something.
Thank you. Anybody else on why the bodies were taken down? About the legs being broken? Bart?
Yeah, Logan said it very well. We talked a little bit about the physiology of why water would come forth. And Dakota's, I don't think Dakota's here, but you develop an effusion in the potential pleural space that surrounds your lungs. And you're undergoing an agonizing life-ending event like this, or frankly, people in the ICUs and so on. Sometimes doctors have to put a tube into their lungs, into that potential space, and then water comes up. It's serum. It's 95% water. And so that's what had happened with the Lord. And that's why it's described as water and blood. So there was both. And so, as Logan pointed out, that is how we are saved. We are saved by Jesus' blood. And we come into contact with that blood through water. That is how you enter the church. The church is the bride of Christ. So, as Johnny in his sermon said 15, 20 years ago now, that's why, you know, we have that story in Genesis about Eve being made from a rib. You know, you read that and you, well, that's an odd thing for God to point out that Eve was made out of Adam's rib. But it's pointing forward to this. Jesus was struck in the side, in the ribs, and then on the day of Pentecost, just a short time later, people were baptized in the church and saved from their sins. So it's an amazing connection, and I think Christians throughout the ages have been understanding it. It's not about the physiology. You know, it's not Luke. It's interesting. It's not Luke telling us this, right? If there was someone that was interested in the physiology as a doctor, it would be Luke. Luke's the doctor. John's not a doctor, and so Luke doesn't say anything about it, as far as I know. John, on the other hand, is the one that tells us.
Yeah, that's a neat connection there with the rib. That was, I saw a lot of explanations and none that I thought were really great, but that rib's pretty good. Who else would like to address the blood and the water, or the legs not being broken, and the bodies being taken down before Sabbath? Well, I mean, as Logan mentioned, it's Sabbath, but it's also the Passover. So it's a big event, and you know, they want that down beforehand, and there's this Jewish, you know, scripture that, you know, to take down the bodies before sundown because it was a curse on the land. Bill?
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to add, the Romans, when they crucified people, they left them on the, they left them hanging. I mean, literally until the birds ate them or they fell, decayed, and fell apart. And so, you know, that was going to be their plan. They were walking away. They've done what they were told to do. And now it's the Jews that come forward asking to have this cleaned up.
Right. Yeah, and it probably goes back to that. Take the body down before sundown, I would think. And we also have some scripture about, in Zechariah 12:10, about look on me whom they pierce. So we have that fulfillment there. Awesome.
Another verse is Psalm 22, verse 14, which says, I am poured out like water.
Let's move on to question number 5. Why is the testimony of John as a witness so important? Why did John give this testimony? And what verses were fulfilled in the aftermath of Jesus' death? Bart?
Well, I don't have too much here. But John is important because he's an eyewitness. None of the other apostles or disciples were eyewitnesses of Jesus' death. They were all somewhere else. The women, of course, would be there and say. So John is an eyewitness, and this is years later probably. Most people think it's sometime later, perhaps the last gospel to be written. And John is saying, you can believe this because I saw it. And he also, and maybe perhaps the most significant thing is he saw that soldier take that spear and jab it up into the Lord. To, you know, the soldier is making sure Jesus is dead. You know, are you faking it? You know, the soldier's job, they didn't have many jobs at crucifixion, but one of their jobs was to make sure these condemned criminals die. Now, that'd be super embarrassing if your condemned criminal shows up later somewhere else. Wasn't that your job? You had one job. And so the soldier takes that spear and jams it into the Lord, and he's dead. And so John, the apostle, saw that. And so he knows that anyone who says Jesus wasn't dead and that he was just carried away somewhere and revived is lying, because Jesus actually was dead.
Yep. John was there, and he was there from the Last Supper to here, and he was there the whole time, too. So he knew Jesus well. It's a very good eyewitness account. Who else would like to address the importance of John giving this witness and the verses fulfilled? Well, the reason, he tells us the reason, so you may believe, in verse 35. That's the reason John wrote this. And I think I didn't put these verses up there. We have what verses were fulfilled in the aftermath of Jesus' death. Exodus 12:46. In the house it shall be eaten, you shall not carry any of its flesh outside the house, nor shall you break any of its bones. That's a Passover lamb. I think Logan mentioned that or a similar verse a minute ago. Numbers 9:12. They shall leave none of it until morning, nor break one of its bones. According to all the ordinances of the Passover, they shall keep it. And we've already covered Psalm 34:20 and then Zechariah 12:10 once. Look on the one in the next figures. Let's move on to the last question. Question number 6. What lessons are to be learned that Joseph and Nicodemus were the ones who took care of the body of Jesus and not the disciples? What was involved in a Jewish burial? And why were they concerned about the Jews' preparation day, and what impact did it have? Landon?
So what lessons are there to be learned from Joseph and Nicodemus being the ones that took care of Jesus' body? Well, obviously, we know that the faith that they had in Jesus that they were hiding was obviously shown out to the world here. They took Jesus' body, and they wrapped it with herbs and cloves, and that's typically what Jewish burial involved. Kaufman says, John seems to have introduced Joseph, Arimathea, and Nicodemus a moment later to demonstrate that weak and timid faith on their part had come out dramatically into the open on this occasion. John notes, I think it's in chapter 20, when Jesus has risen, he seems very knowledgeable about typical Jewish burials, and he talks about a handkerchief that had been placed on Jesus' head. That was a custom that was explaining it to us, and it was a custom that instead of wrapping the face, in case the person was still alive, they would put a handkerchief that covered their nose and mouth so they could blow it off if they were still alive and be able to get the attention of some grievers that could be there. And so, obviously, John had a lot of knowledge about this, and potentially he was a Christianized Jew from all the knowledge he seems to have. And then, what was the last question? Why were they concerned about the Jews' preparation day, and what impact did it have? Well, I mean, that's the whole reason the Jews wanted Jesus taken down from the cross, because the Sabbath was coming up, and Nicodemus and Joseph were Jews, and so it's something they've been doing their entire life, And I'm not sure if they completely understood what was going to happen with Jesus. If I was a Jew, I probably would have still obeyed the Sabbath day, but I think it probably would have been all right if they went to Jesus' body the day before. But I don't know.
Very good. Who else would like to address Joseph and Nicodemus and the preparation day? Austin.
As far as the preparation day, there is a point. There's obviously more debate to be had on this than we have time for, but the timing that they would have had to make sure that it was done before the Sabbath day is key in fulfilling the 3 days that he was in the ground. If it's done after the Sabbath day, that there's no way that's fulfilled. But because it's before Friday, the whole day, the way that the Jews counted time, it would count for Friday, for Saturday, then he was resurrected on Sunday. So there is significance, and again, completely outside of Jesus' control now, is making sure that he is in the ground, relying on other people to do it. And to me, there's no other way to look at that than the work of God being carried out.
Yes, very good. If Friday's the day of execution, Joseph or Nicodemus being devout Jews, they are key in this and getting the 3 days in the ground. And, you know, it's I think Bart mentioned, only disciple we have recorded there is John. Others probably scattered, so they wouldn't be able to get it done. And if Joseph and Nicodemus didn't get it done, it would probably go to the Romans, and then we would have no account of where the body was, and there would be all sorts of innuendo of what happened. Anybody else in this?
Yeah, real quick, I like the first part of this question. What lessons are there to be learned from that Joseph and Nicodemus were the ones that took care of the body? when I worked on this at home, I was thinking that you don't have to be a high profile or an important person in man's eyes to do good works for the Lord. That was kind of a lesson for me that I thought about. But then I'm just sitting right here thinking, wait a minute, Nicodemus was a high profile person. So we can flip it around the other way. You could still be a high profile person and get your hands dirty and do menial work that would have defiled these guys for the Lord.
Yeah, that's important. That's a good point. It defiled. Another important point about Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea being high-profile guys is that they were members of the council, and they knew Jesus was dead. There was no getting around it. You know, they knew that, and so it made an important point to the Jews there. Anybody else on this? The new tomb, I never thought about this before, but we have in 2 Kings, a person gets thrown in the tomb of Elisha and jumps up. So we have a new tomb. There's no air room for rumor that Jesus was brought up by some Old Testament prophet by getting thrown in somebody else's tomb. And then, of course, we have the fulfillment of prophecy in Isaiah 53:9. Made his grave with the rich, with the wicked, but at the rich at his death. There was somebody was pointing out that we think about the grave with the wicked of being crucified with the thieves. But he would have also had a grave made for him with the wicked, because the Romans would have had him a place to go to bury him when he's done, when he died. So it could also apply to the grave, who he's crucified. Anybody else before we close? Well, we're a little bit over. It's time to close.